Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Good to have you here with us. I am your host, Cy Kellett. And thank you to all the fill-in hosts who filled in over the course of the last 9 days or so. And that would be Jerry, John, Don, and Matt. Right? Did I get everybody? Mm-hmm. Should I do the last names? I don't know if I can remember.
They were very filling.
They were filling? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I had some filling stuff.
Uh-huh. While you were on the cruise?
Yeah, bread pudding.
Oh.
And
how exotic.
Yeah. Is bread pudding exotic?
No.
I was going to say, what planet are you living in? Our guest this hour, of course, is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy.
And it is open forum today, 2 hours of questions and answers on any topic you like having to do with the Catholic Church, which any question at all you've got about the Catholic Church is welcome. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. You don't have to be Catholic to call, but the lines can fill up quickly for open forum, so give us a call with your question, 888-31-TRUTH. And Jimmy, in addition to being the senior apologist here, is also, you can find him on jimmyakin.com, which mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you about. I got a question about that.
Okay.
You're well known for your various scripture commentaries and commentaries on Doctor Who. And those are
true.
Two different things. I want you to know.
Yeah.
And you're the author of this book, among others, this book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And I'm going to give you a question from the book, Jimmy.
Okay, but I don't know what it is.
No.
You and I have never worked together before.
We have. Don't exaggerate. We have worked together before, although it doesn't seem like work.
But we're not colluding
when I'm working
on this.
You.
I don't know what this question
I'm just,
is.
And people on the internets can see that I am just finding a page.
Oh, come on. You could have had your thumb holding it open slightly.
I'm going to damage the book trying to find a way to do this completely randomly. But okay. I wanted to ask you about something.
Okay, sure.
On jimmyakin.com, mm-hmm. you do the Weekly Francis.
Yes. Well, I have the Weekly Francis there.
Oh, so tell me about that. I was looking at it today.
Back during the reign of Pope Benedict, I realized Pope Benedict had all of these great texts that he was producing because the Pope, he didn't write them all, but he gives them all. There can be letters to various groups. They can be messages for various purposes. There's a weekly Wednesday audience that recent popes have used as an occasion for teaching, you know, basic catechetical stuff. And the total number of documents that the Pope produces is just totally staggering.
Uh-huh.
Now, like I said, he didn't write them all. He didn't spend all day writing them. He's got ghostwriters and stuff, but he approves them and reads them. And they're issued in his name. And so I wanted to have a kind of place where I could read whatever Pope Benedict had written and keep up, you know, with what all the different things he was saying and doing. And so I found a way to do that. I developed a system from using the Vatican's website to get links to all of the places where there were English translations
okay.
of these things.
Right.
And then I linked them and I made it the Weekly Benedict. And then Jeff Miller of the Curt Jester, who's another well-known blogger, got interested in it, and he started taking the Weekly Benedict and turning it into little ebooks for people who wanted to be able to read it ebook style. And eventually he took over curating it. And so even though it still appears on my blog, it's actually Jeff Miller who compiles it these days. And when, you know, the shift happened from Pope Benedict to Pope Francis, it became the Weekly Francis. And the plan is, as we go forward, you know, whenever there's a new pope, we'll just change the name and continue the service for people who want to keep up with whatever the Pope's most recently been doing in terms of writing and speaking.
888-318-7884 is our number. Jimmy Akin, our guest. And again, I am Cy Kellett, your host, and I say it because I'm really happy to be back. It's really nice. I'm glad I get to start with you, Jimmy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I might have done this question
before. No, don't start with me.
No, just start back at work.
Oh, okay.
But I'm wondering if I might have done this question with you before. But you know what? Maybe
we'll find out.
Since I can't really remember, we'll go for it. It's day number 190 in A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And it's the Whore of Babylon.
Oh, okay.
The Catholic Church is the Whore of Babylon. Pardon my language.
Nah.
You just say nah. That's actually the page just says the word nah on it. That's not really true.
So when we read the book, now this is a charge that developed out of the Reformation era because you had the reformers were breaking away from the Catholic Church, which was universally recognized at the time in Europe as being the true church. And, you know, it was huge. It was everywhere. If you were in Western Europe, unless you were a Jew, you were a Catholic. And so the reformers needed to have some kind of alternative account of what is this? What is this? What is this? If it's not the Bride of Christ, what is it?
Yeah.
And so they looked around in Scripture and they said, ah, okay, well, here in the book of Revelation, in contrast to the Bride of Christ, which is the church, which descends from heaven in a special way at the end of the book of Revelation, you have the Bride of Christ being contrasted with this other similar feminine opposite figure called the Whore of Babylon. And so they seized on that and said, okay, the Catholic Church is the Whore of Babylon, and that's our alternative account of what the Catholic Church is and why it can be so big. It's not the real Bride of Christ. It's this false opposite, you know, anti-image of the Bride of Christ. The problem is it doesn't fit with what we read in Revelation about the Whore of Babylon. There are some things that kind of do fit. Babylon, it was used in first century Jewish and Christian documents as a kind of code word for Rome, because Babylon had been the great persecutor of the Jewish people several centuries before, and now Rome was the great persecutor of the Jewish people and the Christian people, and so Babylon became a kind of code word for Rome, and so that kind of fits. And also, the Whore of Babylon is depicted as being seated on seven hills, which the city of Rome famously is. And so those kind of data points could fit, but that doesn't mean they point to the Catholic Church. That just means they point – if this theory is even correct, that they point to Rome.
Yeah.
But which Rome? The one before its conversion to Christianity or the one after? Well, if you keep reading in the book of Revelation, you find out that that the whore has persecuted apostles, and this doesn't fit with the view that this is something that applies to the Catholic Church, because according to the standard Reformation era polemic, the Catholic Church didn't even exist in the first century. Otherwise, it would be Christ Church.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it didn't exist until after the Apostolic Age, how could the Whore of Babylon persecute apostles? Also, the whore is shown as being in alliance with the beast with seven heads and ten horns. And if you do a careful study of that, it looks like we're told that the seven heads are seven kings. And if you study about them, it looks like we're talking about the line of first century Roman emperors.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it looks like when you take all of the evidence into account, this is not talking about a church. It's talking about a city that's the capital of the major empire of the day, and it's Rome. Or there's an alternative case that it might be Jerusalem. Because there is one of the passages in the book of Revelation that talks about the great city, which elsewhere is another designation for the Whore of Babylon. And it talks about the two witnesses. There are these two witnesses that will prophesy for a period in Revelation that seem to symbolize Moses and Elijah, the law and the prophets. And then they're killed, and it says their bodies are going to lie in the streets of the great city where also their Lord was crucified.
Oh, so that.
And so the city where the Lord was crucified is obviously Jerusalem. And
right.
Did Jerusalem persecute Christians and apostles?
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. And did it have an alliance with the seven-headed beast of the line of Roman emperors in the persecution of Christians?
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. So there's an alternative theory. The whore is either Rome or Jerusalem, or it could be some kind of symbol that incorporates both Rome and Jerusalem somehow.
Mm-hmm. Like the contemporary system.
Yeah, really, kind of the system. You know, the great city, whatever the great city happens to be.
Right.
The great city, wherever you are, is likely to be a repository of evil.
That came from a Daily Defense. Well, that came from Jimmy Akin, the author of the Daily Defense, and that's day 190. And we'll take a quick break and we'll come back with Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. 888-318-7884 is the number. And Anne on Facebook says that she and her son are loving a Daily Defense, sometimes use it as a kind of test for each other. And she says, yes, they are nerds. But I don't think that you have to be a nerd to read a Daily Defense. We'll be right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can book any of our great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm really excited to tell you about a special limited-time offer we've got right now on subscriptions of our award-winning Catholic Answers magazine. Sign up today during our annual subscription drive, and not only can you save big bucks off the normal price, you can get a collection of 5 exclusive audio presentations added to your order for free. Subscribe today at 818-487-2011 or online at Catholic.com. Sign up for a 1-year subscription, and we'll give you $10 off the normal price. Better yet, become a 2-year subscriber and we'll up the ante by dropping the price $20 and sending you a customized Catholic Answers flash drive containing exclusive talks from a top-notch line of speakers, including Chris Check, Carla Broussard, Tim Staples, Cy Kellett, and my talk, Answering Atheism. That's a savings of $20 plus 5 brand new audio presentations when you sign up for a 2-year subscription to Catholic Answers Magazine. Act now. This is our best offer of the year and it's only available for a limited time. Subscribe to Catholic Answers Magazine before our annual subscription drive ends. Phone 818-487-2011 or go to Catholic.com today.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 5:13, Jesus said to his disciples, "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt loses its taste, with what can it be seasoned? It is no longer of any use. You are the light of the world. Your light must shine before others, that they may see your good example and glorify your Heavenly Father." In many ways, we Catholics blend in with a greater population. Culturally, we are very much the same. What distinguishes us, other than the fact that we attend the local Catholic Church? Do we pray grace in restaurants? Do we dress more modestly than is the current norm? Are we found at daily Mass? Are we openly pro-life with those who would disagree? How willing are we to risk disapproval for our commitment to our faith? How much do we really love Him? Now, what are our Catholic answers? I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, Father Paul Keller, the second hour. And Jimmy, how about we go straight to calls?
Let's please.
All right. Craig in Trabuco Canyon, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Craig, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. How are you?
Just fine. What's your question?
Well, I'd like, first of all, just to thank you for all you've done for me. You've helped me tremendously in my growth as in Catholicism. And we lost a child a couple of years ago to a drunk driver. And I credit this program with a lot of the healing that me and my family have. So thank you for Catholic Answers. And thank you for everything that you do for us.
Thank you. It's an honor for us to have played a role. And our hearts go out to you. And I encourage the listeners to pray for your child and for the healing of your family and for everybody in similar situations.
Thank you so much. So my question is, I love the readings of St. Padre Pio, and I was wondering, what is the official Catholic view of the stigmata with Padre Pio? You get on the internet and you see some crazy stuff about the use of carbolic acid and things like that, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering if you could maybe just shed some light on how the stigmata was studied and what the Vatican's view is of this. Thank you so much.
Obviously now St. Padre Pio is a saint, and so the Church believes that he died in a state of holiness and that that he's in heaven now interceding on behalf of people, in terms of the various mystical phenomena that were reported during his life, the fact that someone's a saint doesn't mean the church automatically endorses whatever's reported about a saint and mystical phenomena in this life. Those phenomena are kind of a separate issue from the issue of is this person in heaven or not. And so just as a matter of general principle, if you know someone's in heaven because they're a saint, you kind of have to independently look at the question of various mystical phenomena that are reported in connection with them and make an independent assessment of those. I personally am not an expert in the biography of St. Padre Pio, and so I don't know what investigations may have been undertaken in regard to stigmata in his case. I know stigmata – by the way, I should probably explain for people who are listening who may not know what stigmata are. Stigma is the Greek word for mark and for a mark. Like if you make a mark on a piece of paper, that's a stigma. And stigmata is the plural. And so if so Jesus, because of the wounds he suffered – had the marks of crucifixion on his body or the stigmata of crucifixion on his body. And periodically in the course of church history, really beginning about the time of St. Francis, he's really the first person to significantly report this as far as I am aware, although some people would appeal to a passage in St. Paul, but I don't think that's what he's talking about. But from St. Francis forward, he reported a mystical phenomena of having the marks of Christ's crucifixion appear on his own body as a kind of mystical identification with Christ. In some cases, the stigmata are held to physically manifest, so you could actually see them. In other cases, it's thought to be a kind of inward visionary manifestation that is accessible to the person who actually has them. But in Padre Pio's case, it was held to be visibly manifest. And so you even see pictures of Padre Pio with, you know, wounds in the palms of his hands and so forth, the photographs, not just illustrations. And I am just personally unaware of any investigations that were done by the church regarding those. So I don't know if they've been officially declared miracles or not. I would suggest checking a biography of Padre Pio, if you know, preferably one of the more scholarly ones, rather than one of the more popular ones, that's more likely to have information of that nature. Frankly, my first stop would probably be Wikipedia, and just to see, do they have some citations to other sources, both pro and con, that I could then go look at and see, okay, did his superior or the local bishop ever do an official investigation of these, and what were the findings of that investigation? So that would actually be my first stop in trying to trace back to some primary sources to see what kind of investigation may have been done.
Okay, Craig?
Very good. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for that call, Craig. 888-318-7884. The number, open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin taking any question that you've got on the life, faith, history, morals of the Catholic Church. We go now to Morrow in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Morrow, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello. Yes, thank you for taking my question. First and foremost, welcome back, Si. Glad that you're back.
Oh, very nice of you. Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah. And hello, Jimmy. How are you?
I'm doing okay. What's your question?
Great. So I have your book, Daily Defense. Mm-hmm. It's a really, really good book. I really enjoy it.
Thank you.
Basically, my question, I know that you have some pages there that are referring to Intercession of the Saints and some that focus on statues and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And the second commandment. So what exactly does the second commandment condemn? Because I have seen one of your pages said that the word images was maybe kind of like improperly translated, or mm-hmm. that it actually condemns statues but not images. So what's the deal with the second commandment and our statues of our saints?
Okay. We kind of need to be a little careful here because there are different ways of numbering the Ten Commandments. And So when we talk about the second commandment as Catholics, we're typically using a numbering system that's used by Catholics and Lutherans. But if you're a Jew, there's another numbering system. And if you're a Calvinist or an Eastern Orthodox, there's a third numbering system. And what counts as the second commandment actually depends on which numbering system you're using. In the system that we're using, it includes the commandment about you're not to have any graven images, you're not to bow down to them and worship them and so forth like that. What it's talking about is idols. That's fundamentally what it's talking about. We're not to have idols of deities. We're not to be worshiping Baal, to cite a common one, or Ashtoreth, or Osiris, or Marduk, or any of the ancient pagan deities that were commonly worshipped through the use of idols. That's really what it's talking about. Now, that's a little less clear in some of the numbering systems we have today, like in the Protestant or the Calvinist, and although they're not Protestants, also used commonly by the Eastern Orthodox numbering system, there's a division between you shall have no other gods before me and you shall not have any statues or images that you use. And that division is unfortunate. In the Catholic version, that's united with the you shall have no other gods before me. And also in the Jewish numbering system, which I think actually has a good case to be the one originally intended by the sacred author, those two are united as well. In the Jewish numbering system, the first commandment is, I am the Lord your God.
Oh, and it just stops right there.
Yeah, and that's the first, because they're not called actually commandments in Hebrew. They're called the 10 words or the 10 things.
Decalogue.
That's Latin.
But that's Latin for 10 words, right?
Ten words, yes.
Yeah.
So the first word, the most important thing, I am the Lord your God. And then from that, it flows, you shall have no other gods before me and you're not going to use any idols. And that's really what's being talked about. So since the statues that Catholics use are not idols, we don't believe that they are manifestations of divinities. It doesn't fall under this commandment. In the first place, most of them are not statues of individuals that are divine at all. They're statues of other human beings or maybe angels. But we recognize these are finite beings. They're not divinities. We don't consider them to be divinities. This is just a holy person, whether it's a holy human being or a holy angel, that we're paying our respects to and that we want to think about and remember, and we're using this as a kind of memory aid. In the case of like statues of Jesus, well, okay, so Jesus is a divine person, but what's different is Jesus actually took on human form. This was one of the citations or one of the reasons in the Old Testament why the Jews were told not to use idols was God had not revealed himself to them under any particular visible form, whether of a man or a reptile or anything else like that. And so with the incarnation, there was something fundamental that did change. God united himself to a visible form and became a human. He was fully human and fully divine. And so at that point, it became illicit to make depictions of Jesus's human form. It wouldn't have been sinful to, you know, if you got in a TARDIS and went back to the first century and whipped out your iPhone, you could take his picture and that wouldn't be a sin. And so having depictions of Jesus's physical human form is nothing – there's nothing wrong with that. And as long as you recognize this is just a depiction, it's not really Jesus. And so you don't direct to the image of Jesus the worship that you would give to the actual person of Jesus. The image is just a memory aid.
How's that work for you, Mauro?
It works really well. And I guess that would also apply to the Eucharist as well, I guess, because the Eucharist is Christ.
Yes.
So
you're not worshiping the appearances of bread and wine, but you are worshiping Jesus, who is bodily and otherwise present there in the Eucharist.
Thank you very much for that call, Mauro. I think we're going to take a break here. Would people worshiped Marmaduke? Why did you say people worshiped
Marduk? The Babylonian storm deity.
Oh.
Not the Great
Dane
in the comics.
No. Okay, I gotcha. Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Taking any question you've got on the life or faith of the Catholic Church. You don't have to be Catholic to call. We encourage calls from non-Catholics, those who are curious, those who might have a challenge to pose to us. 888-318-7884 is that number. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popcheck.
More to Life is about living the Catholic difference in our marriages, our families, the way we approach life in general.
It's about celebrating life and our Catholic faith and discovering all the ways God wants to bless us and help us be a blessing to others.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popcheck. Weekdays, 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Hey everyone, this is Carlo Broussard, and I'm really excited to tell you about a special limited time offer we've got right now on subscriptions of our award-winning Catholic Answers magazine. Sign up today during our annual subscription drive, and not only can you save big bucks off the normal price, you can get a collection of 5 exclusive audio presentations added to your order for free. Subscribe today at 818-487-2011. Or online at Catholic.com. Sign up for a 1-year subscription and we'll give you $10 off the normal price. Better yet, become a 2-year subscriber and we'll up the ante by dropping the price $20 and sending you a customized Catholic Answers flash drive containing exclusive talks from a top-notch lineup of speakers including Chris Check, Tim Staples, Trent Horn, and Cy Kellett, and my talk, The Splendor of the Catholic Faith. That's a savings of $20 plus 5 brand new audio presentations when you sign up for a 2-year subscription to Catholic Answers Magazine. Act now. This is our best offer of the year, and it's only available for a limited time. Subscribe to Catholic Answers Magazine before our annual subscription drive ends. Phone 818-487-2011 or go to Catholic.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. So happy to have you with us. Open forum today. But the lines do fill up. 888-318-7884 is the number. Catholic Answers Magazine subscription drive is almost at the halfway point, Jimmy. And Father's Day is coming up Sunday, so that's a really good Father's Day gift for this Sunday. And the annual Catholic Answers subscription drive, you sign up for a 1-year subscription, we give you $10 off the normal price. A 2-year subscription, $20 off the normal price, and we send you the customized Catholic Answers flash drive containing 5 exclusive talks from a top-notch lineup of apologists, including Christopher Check, Tim Staples, Trent Horn, Carla Broussard, and one sad one from our Catholic Answers host, Cy Kellett, who is me.
No. I'm sure you're happy in it.
I don't think it shows, but Now you should be so fascinated. Like, well, I got to hear that one. Just call it. You can go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com to subscribe, CatholicAnswersMagazine.com, or you can call 844-589-1597, 844-589-1597. Again, open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Any question that you've got, life, faith, history of the Catholic Church, we're happy to take. We go now to Brendan in Houston, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Brendan, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. How are you all?
Good,
doing
thank
fine.
You.
What's your question?
Thank you. Okay. So my question is, are lustful thoughts, impurity thoughts, particularly unwanted thoughts, are they immortal sins?
It's going to depend. If they're unwanted, meaning you're not willing them, then no, they're not going to be a mortal sin because you're not doing them with deliberation. In order for something to be a mortal sin, there has to be grave matter. There has to be full knowledge of its moral character. In other words, that this is grave matter. And there has to be deliberate consent to it as well. And if you're just having thoughts occurring to you that you don't want, you're trying to get out of your head, even if there's some temptation there, even if there's a momentary wavering, but you get it out of your head, that's not you're not deliberately engaging in these lustful thoughts. And so they're not going to count as mortal sins. They may not count as sins at all. They may just be temptations. There has to be some form of consent in order for there to be actual sin. On the other hand, if they are initially unwanted, but then you say, hey, this is kind of pleasant, I'm going to indulge this, well, there you're engaging deliberately. And so it can – they can be the occasion of mortal sin. So it's really going to depend on the situation and whether or not you're giving deliberate consent to these or not.
Brent?
Okay. Yep, thank you.
Okay,
hope
thank
that
you,
helps. And this is something, you know, if you need a little bit of scriptural backup for this, that this really is something that needs to be taken seriously. This is something Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount. You might want to look in Matthew chapter 5, where he doesn't let people off with the excuse of, well, I didn't really commit adultery. He says, if you looked at a woman for purposes of lusting at her, you've committed adultery with her in your heart, and it's just as serious as adultery, meaning it can be a mortal sin.
Thank you very much, Brendan, for that call. We go now to Jeff in Arizona, listening on 1310 AM Immaculate Heart Radio. Jeff, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Si. Hey, Jimmy. I've got a question for you regarding sacrament of marriage and convalidation.
Okay.
So my wife and I were married 23 years ago. My wife was baptized, communed, and confirmed Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
But when we met and started dating and got engaged, she had converted to the Episcopal Church where I was going, and we were married in the Episcopal Church.
Okay.
Now, we didn't realize at the time that that she was still under canonical law bound by the Catholic Church's doctrines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our intention and our understanding was that we were getting married in the church, in a sacramental marriage, in the Episcopal Church, and in the eyes of God.
Mm-hmm.
So right now we're in the process of going through convalidation.
Okay.
What I'm trying to find out is what is the church's stance on what our current state is?
Okay.
As far as, is our marriage considered valid, you know, as far as valid, licit, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And is our marriage seen by the Catholic Church any differently than like if we had just gone to a justice of a peace or a Vegas Elvis and gotten married?
Okay. Well, obviously it's different than going to a Vegas Elvis because you were trying to be reverent and in your eyes you were you know, attempting to engage in authentic marriage. You weren't treating it flippantly or anything like that. So there's obviously a difference there. In terms of its fundamental status. Now, you said that – let me make sure I understand this. Your wife was baptized and confirmed Catholic but had become an Episcopalian. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So when she became an Episcopalian, I imagine she typically would have been confirmed as an Episcopalian. Is that correct?
I know she went through class. I'm trying to remember if it was specifically a confirmation or not, but – I do know that she had to go through kind of like an RCIA type thing to enter into the Episcopal Church.
Okay. I don't know in the case of someone who is already been confirmed as a Catholic, but I know typically when one joins the Episcopal Church, they do confirm you, but they may not have in her case, so I can't be sure of that. You said this also happened 23 years ago, correct? So it would have happened circa 1994?
Correct. Yes, we were married in 94, actually.
Okay.
Yesterday was our anniversary, or Sunday was our anniversary.
Oh, okay. The reason I ask is because the law has changed in this area. When the 1983 Code of Canon Law was released, it contained a provision that said if a person has defected from the Catholic Church by a formal act of defection, then they are no longer subject to the requirement to be married in the Catholic Church. And the law after the year 2000 changed a couple of times on this. The problem was there was an ambiguity dealing with what counts as formal defection. And eventually there was a clarification on that took a rather strict interpretation of what would have counted as a formal defection, to where you had to basically like write a letter to your bishop saying, I no longer consider myself a Catholic. But that extended the law, and one of the principles in canon law is when an interpretation extends the law to something you couldn't have guessed before that this would have been required, it's not retroactive. And so during the period that you two attempted marriage in the Episcopal Church, if the marriage would have been valid if your wife had defected from the Catholic Church by a formal act, and it wouldn't necessarily have to be writing a letter to your bishop. That would count, but there could be other things that would count as well, such as formally joining another church with the understanding, I'm no longer a Catholic. So I would say, without knowing anything more, I can't make an assessment about what the whether your marriage at the time was valid or not. It sounds to me like there's a good chance it was valid and that therefore your marriage is valid now. Whether or not, assuming there's nothing else involved, like one of you had a prior divorce or something like that, but assuming there's nothing else involved, your marriage could be valid right now. However, it can still be reasonable to go ahead and proceed with a convalidation just to be sure.
Okay, and that's what we're doing. I was just kind of curious as to, like, what our current state was, because we were kind of, you know, we weren't sure, is it, you know, were we considered to be in mortal sin or you know, just this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. So I just want to try and get some clarification on that.
Yeah, well, it sounds like to me if your wife considered herself no longer Catholic and undertook some formal act of joining another church, like going through the equivalent of an RCIA and then being officially received into the Episcopal Church, to me that sounds like it would count as formal defection under the law at the time.
Okay, so now I'm in the process, like we're in the process of getting convalidated because I'm getting ready to start RCIA in the fall,
mm-hmm.
so that I can enter into the Catholic Church and she's come back to the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Is there anything as far as, you know, her coming back that has to be done if she formally declared?
She just needs to go to confession.
Or
she just needs to go to confession.
Okay. Yes, she's done that. Okay. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Thanks, Jeff. RCIA, he said, beginning RCIA in the fall, and that is the common. I like to just take that opportunity for those who are considering entering the Catholic Church. In mm-hmm. most parishes that offer the RCIA, they will begin classes sometime over the course of the summer or in the fall.
Right. Yeah. So we probably want to explain for listeners who don't know the jargon. RCIA stands for Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults. And the process is actually designed for people who've never been baptized. And that's why these classes tend to start in the fall. So people tend to be, you know, traveling around in the summer and stuff, but they need a certain period of instruction before they get baptized at Easter, which is the traditional time for people to be baptized. However, because you also have a bunch of people who have already been baptized, they're already Christians, but they're joining the Catholic Church, they're often, even though they're not going to be baptized into the Catholic Church. They'll be received into it and maybe confirmed as well if they haven't been confirmed elsewhere validly. They all often, for just logistical purposes, are also go through basically the same classes in a typical parish, even though that's not strictly required.
And if you don't know for certain, oh, I want to enter the Catholic Church, if you're just inquiring mm-hmm. in a general way, these are fine for you. You're welcome.
You can go into, and figure it out as you go.
And so I hope that you will take that as an invitation. The Catholic Church welcomes you, and you have an opportunity in almost every parish, not in all parishes, but in almost every parish, an opportunity to do that. Again, 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live, and we'll be right back with more after this.
Call now, Catholic Answers Live.
Right now, Catholic Answers is conducting its summer campaign. It's a crucial time because we need to offset the drop in donations that occurs every summer. If you're able to give $50 or more, to thank you for your support, we have several gifts we'd like to send you. First, a signed copy of the full 3-CD set, Lepanto, The Battle That Saved the West, so that you can get the full story about this crucial, history-changing intervention of Our Lady of the Rosary. We'll also send you the three latest volumes in our 20 Answers series. They cover apparitions and revelations, witchcraft and the occult, and the church. If you're able to donate $90 or or more, we'll also send you Carlo Broussard's CD, Your Truth, My Truth, How to Understand and Refute Relativistic Thinking, which has a free 38-page downloadable study guide. We'll also send you Stephen Weidenkopf's 2-CD set, The Real Story of the Reformation, just in time for its 500th anniversary. And we'll send you Dr. Edward Sree's new book, Who Am I to Judge? Responding to Relativism with Logic and Love. Finally, if you're able to donate $180 or more, we'll also send you Trent Horn's 12-part audio interview series, The Apologetics Collection, in which he picks the brains of people like Carl Keating, Jimmy Akin, Tim Staples, Patrick Madrid, Steve Ray, Devin Rose, and more on a host of the most pressing apologetic issues. Finally, we'll send you a hardback copy of the beautiful, illustration-filled book, Fatima Mysteries, Mary's Message in the Modern Age, just in time for the celebrations happening now of the famous Fatima apparitions, which took place exactly 100 years ago. Every year, Catholic Answers seeks to win souls for Christ in countless ways, but we can't do this without your help. To learn how you can help Catholic Answers, visit Catholic.com and click the 2017 Summer Campaign banner. That's the 2017 Summer Campaign banner at Catholic.com.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live. Our topic, well, what's on your mind? Anything that you'd like to know about the Catholic Church, about the life of faith, about the maybe a moral question that you have, we're happy to take those. And Jimmy, we have lots of folks who now watch the show live on YouTube or Facebook, yep, or even Periscope, which a lot of people have never heard of.
Yeah, but it's connected with Twitter.
Yeah, it's a Twitter video. On YouTube, Andrew asks the following question. Mm-hmm. I think he was trying to call because it says, sorry, Jimmy, having no luck getting through.
Right. He's from the UK. And apparently, so I saw someone else, Julius Caesar, also, I guess, from the UK, was having trouble calling on the international line today. So there may be some kind of international phone difficulty.
And also, Julius Caesar lives 2,000 years ago.
It's hard. Do not hold that against him, okay?
Oh, sorry. I was being ageist.
Well,
I was
temporalist.
I was a temporalist, right? But this is what Andrew says. Hope to you get a chance to answer. Where do we get the list of the first popes from, mm-hmm, and how are they validated?
Okay. We get them from the writings of the early church fathers. They talk about who – they not only talk about who was the Bishop of Rome in their own day, but they also talk about the line of bishops in Rome and in other sees as well. So one of the primary sources for that is the church historian Eusebius of Caesarea. He lived in the early 300s. He wrote a classic book called Ecclesiastical History or Church History. It covered the history of the church up to his own age. And in it, he gives various lists of the bishops of different important sees. A see is from the Latin word for seat, the seat of different important bishops. He gives Rome, he gives Antioch, he gives Jerusalem. And it's kind of neat with the Jerusalem one because he gives the list of the guys. There's like 15 of them up to the second Jewish rebellion in AD 32 to 35.
That's a tough job then.
Yeah, well, there was. and he notes that because the first one, the first Bishop of Rome after the apostles, James, he lasted until AD 62, and then you've got like 14 more guys.
Oh, that's
awful. And he notes that they really each served a short time, and they were all Jewish. But then when the second Jewish rebellion occurred, the Bar Kokhba rebellion, the Romans, once they conquer Jerusalem again, they said, okay, enough of this. No more Jews in this city. We're building a temple to a pagan god on the site of their temple, so they can't come worship here anymore. We're kicking them all out of the city. And at that point, Jerusalem got its first Gentile bishop.
Mm-hmm.
He not only does that for Jerusalem, he does that for other major Christian centers as well, including Rome. And we have various other sources that then part of Andrew's question was, how is this validated? We then have other Christian sources that testify to different aspects of it. And the farther into church history we get, the more sources we have that have survived, and we have more and more ability to cross-check exactly who is Bishop of Rome at particular times. There, in these early lists, there can be some differences. Sometimes it's a difference of how a name is spelled, like the third pope is sometimes – his name is Cletus, sometimes listed as Cletus or Anacletus. It's really just two forms of the same name. Occasionally, there is a more substantive difference in some lists, like Clement of Rome. In some lists, he's depicted as if he's the fourth pope. So Peter, Linus, Cletus, Clement, he'd be the fourth. But in other times, he's depicted as if he's the immediate successor of Peter. However, that it could instead be a memory of the fact that he was ordained as a priest by Peter directly, yeah, and then later became bishop.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some issues. We'd like to have more sources to be able to settle in the very earliest period, but that there was a line of bishops in Rome from the first century onward is not in doubt any more than it's in doubt in other cities. And we have these sources, even if they occasionally contain minor differences, they agree in substance, and that's what's important for establishing the overall line.
All right, Andrew, thank you very much for that. Jimmy, if I may ask, sometimes the reckoning of time in the ancient world is different than the reckoning of
yes.
time now. Is the same thing true with names, that like with Cletus and Anacletus, was there a kind of mm-hmm. fluidity in names that we're so like your name is – you know, this and that's it. It's mm-hmm. got to be official on all your documents. Maybe uh-huh. there was less of that then?
There was less of that. People often had multiple names that they used in different social contexts.
Uh-huh.
Like, for example, Mark of the evangelist Mark. Well, so his name in Latin would be Marcus, or mm-hmm. in Greek, Marcos, because they had a different ending on the word. but that wasn't his Jewish name at all. Do you know his Jewish name?
John,
that's right, or yeah. Yohanan. And so you could see he's got two very different
names.
That's
not even close.
It's like not even close.
Yeah.
But even with us, we have some differences. My name actually is Jimmy.
Yeah.
It is not James.
Right.
But people – I did
assume.
For a while go by James, but people
yeah.
frequently assume that
yeah.
it is James, and it's not. So that's an example of some flexibility in our own day. And there can, you know, be even more flexibility yet. I mean, your name may be Cy.
Yeah.
But you could be, you know, Captain Bob 35 in some contexts on the internet.
I told you not to give it away, man. Now, there's probably some guy out there who is Captain Bob 35, and people are going to think it's me. Yeah. Right. And I just the Catholic Answers cruise we just did,
mm-hmm.
several
yeah.
people made fun of me about just teased me that I say my name really fast and that they listened several times before they could
they
figure
your
out.
Your name was Psychelet?
Psychelet, yeah. Like, what is that?
I'll tell a story on me that's even more embarrassing. You know, when you're growing up and you're learning the alphabet, and they have the alphabet song.
Yeah, A, B, C, D.
E, F, G, yeah. Right. Well, they also have those in other languages too for other alphabets. Like when I was taking Aramaic, we learned the Aramaic alphabet song.
Oh, really?
But when I was growing up and in first grade, I thought L, M, N, and O were one letter.
L-M-N-O.
Because of how they're said in the song, you know,
yeah.
L-M-N-O-P. And so I thought L, M, N, and O were just one letter at first. But I got it figured out within that first year.
That's good. I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
I'm glad that didn't stay with you. Cy Kellett.
Kellett.
It's not Cy-Kellett, but I say
yeah.
it that way a lot.
Yeah.
Taylor in Sacramento, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. You're on with Jimmy Akin. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah. So I read an article of Jimmy's the other day about righteousness, where he's making a difference between how Protestants talk about behavioral and legalistic righteousness, and we talked about ontological righteousness. And in that article, man, Jimmy, I love this article. You talked about how in the church, up until the Reformation, whenever we talked about faith, what we meant was intellectual assent.
And that frequently, sort of, frequently, what Catholic theologians would mean by faith was intellectual assent to the truths of theology based on the fact that they're revealed by God who can neither deceive nor be deceived.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that clarification. So that does seem to be the definition of faith that James uses in his epistle and that Jesus uses in Matthew 7. And what I want to ask is, since Protestants don't mean intellectual assent, what they mean is a faith that's united to love, shouldn't we, in our efforts to dialogue with them and reach out to them, just go ahead and affirm, yeah, if what you mean by faith is a heartfelt faith that's united to love, then yeah, you're justified by faith alone. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to get baptized and you can merit an increase in justification, but that kind of faith, sure, that kind of faith alone. Shouldn't we do that?
Well, you know who you sound like? Pope Benedict, because that's exactly what Pope Benedict said in some of his audiences when he was during the year of St. Paul, when he was talking about St. Paul's teaching on justification. He said that Luther's formula, and this is not unique to Pope Benedict, this is widely acknowledged among Catholic theologians, that Luther's formula of faith alone can be given an acceptable meaning if you mean what Catholic theologians refer to as faith formed by charity, charity being the supernatural love of God. So you can give that formula a sensible meaning, and that's why I tend to take a non-confrontational approach to on this issue with our Protestant brothers and sisters. Having said that, there are a couple of important qualifiers that need to be made. One of them is if that's what you mean, because frequently our Protestant brothers and sisters don't mean faith formed by charity when they're talking about the kind of faith that justifies. Some of them will in fact just mean intellectual assent. That's not the majority position, but you will find some who say that. More common is a position that says justifying faith is a combination of faith united with the theological virtue that Catholics would call hope, whereby we trust in God for salvation. And so they'll say, okay, the kind of faith that justifies or justifying faith is intellectual assent to the truth of theology where you trust God to save you, and that's all you need. And they leave the charity portion out. Now, in reality, the charity portion is needed. You need to have that virtue of supernatural love in order to be fully united with God. And so justifying faith actually incorporates all three of the virtues. It includes faith in the intellectual assent sense. It also includes trusting in God for salvation, and it includes the supernatural love of God. So it's faith, hope, and charity together. But that commonly gets expressed in Catholic theology as just faith formed by charity, because wherever you have charity, you automatically have hope and faith. That's why in 1 Corinthians, Paul says that the three are united. If you read 1 Corinthians 13, if you have love, it hopes all things and believes all things. So therefore, whenever you have charity, you've all automatically got hope and faith. So really the key is the charity. And if you make those distinctions, that's fine. We don't want to make it sound like there's just no issues connected with the faith alone formula, in part because it's not used by Scripture. In fact, it rubs against the grain of the language Scripture uses, because the only time the phrase is actually used is in James 2:2, where it's rejected. So even though we can find common ground here and we shouldn't be beating each other over the head here, we should recognize that there are some important distinctions that still need to be made.
Thanks, Taylor. Thanks very much for that call. Thank you, Jimmy Akin. I really enjoyed having an hour with you.
Yeah, likewise. Welcome back.
Yeah. How much do you charge for these sessions? My one hour a week with you.
For you, I'll get you a special deal.
Okay. All right. Good. Next hour, Father Paul Keller will be here. We'll do this all again, and lines are filling up again. Jimmy takes care of some calls, and more calls come in. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-31-TRUTH. If you prefer it that way, Father Paul Keller taking your calls on any aspect
of the life, faith, or history of the Catholic Church on Catholic Answers Open Forum when we come back right after this.